Welcome back into the Ion College Basketball Podcast with CBSSports.com. Hope you're doing well and are perfectly content with your bracket being mangled practically to nothing at this point, or at least something close to that. You know, the tournament, it's different every year, and that's why I love it. You just don't know what kind of results you're going to get, what it will spit out at you. And this one, obviously, we've got, you know, Explorers, Shockers, and the Eagles, of course, of Florida Gulf Coast, which are the biggest story in sports now and the best story, and we'll get plenty of Eagles talk in Dunk City, which I think has to be Dunk Province, if not Dunk Nation at this point. We're bringing on Tim Burke, who is, if you're unfamiliar, he's been on the pod a couple of times, and that whole Manti Te'o story that broke earlier this year, he's one of the two dudes that broke that with Deadspin. Tim, welcome back on, man. How you doing?
I'm fantastic, Matt. How you doing today?
I'm good, man. You've got such an NPR ready voice with that with your microphone setup, dude. It's good to have you back on. For those who might not know, Tim has been a video and gift grabbing extraordinaire for so many years, and he's been following the tournament as much as anyone, and he might even be getting less sleep than me. How have your past 4 days been, buddy?
Well, they've been busy, you know, Matt. It's not just that we have the tournament going on, but my wife and I are planning our wedding reception, which is less than 2 weeks away now. So it has been it's been crazy.
Well, congrats to you on that. That's exciting news. I'm kind of in the same boat. I've got a wedding coming up in May, and I'm kind of it's there, but now the hoops are taking over. And and yeah, man, what a great 4 days. Well, let's just go right to Florida Gulf Coast real quick here, because, I mean, this is unlike anything we've ever seen, man. I mean, you have a compilation of of every dunk up on Deadspin that they threw down, which I thought was fantastic. But, you know, for the first time ever, a 15 is part of the 16, and it's the first time ever that two teams from Florida will play in the tournament against each other, because the Gators will get them out in Dallas, and I'll be seeing that game. Your thoughts on Andy Enfield and the Eagles kind of taking over this tournament and giving us another reason to fall in love again come March?
Well, there's actually quite a few parallels, I think, between this year's tournament and last year's tournament. What you have in the state of Florida this year with Florida, you know, sort of the flagship, and Miami, you know, another kind of major program, and then the out of nowhere Florida Gulf Coast. We had last year in Ohio with Ohio State, Cincinnati, and my alma mater, Ohio. I think, obviously, with Florida Gulf Coast being the first 15 seed to make it to the Sweet 16, we have something that is, you know, obviously unprecedented, but it also kind of shakes up all of your expectations about what the tournament could be from here. And I said this on Twitter, but, you know, now that a 15 seed has made it to the Sweet 16 and done something that nobody's ever done before, we sort of have a license to dream that all of our ridiculous expectations or hopes about where we think the tournament might go and outlandish possibilities, they're not really outlandish anymore, at least in our minds, because something absolutely absurd has happened. And I think that sort of the promise and the hope that comes along with the sort of numerical impossibility is also reflected in the personnel of the Florida Gulf Coast Eagles, and that, you know, you have players like Chase Feeler, right? And this is really sort of, again, personal to me as an Ohio alum. Several members of Chase's family went to Ohio, and he played in Parkersburg, which is obviously should be within, it's Parkersburg is just down the road from Athens, Ohio. He should have been within, you know, the sort of recruiting zone. But then you look at his numbers, and you look at his high school background, and nobody recruited him. He wasn't a high school prospect. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that he ended up in a program that would allow him to, I guess, excel and do things that would not have been expected from him. is reflective of the dreams that have driven FGCU to this point, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I find it such a fascinating program and team for the fact that, you know, obviously the school is so young. I guess it was founded in 91, didn't really get off its feet till a few years after that. The way that it's been able to do this and turn itself into a program that can win tournament games so fast, you know, I was with Rick Bird for a lot of Wednesday out in Salt Lake City, before Belmont got beat by Arizona, and we had talked about, because Belmont was an NAIA school until the mid-90s, and they've made six of the past eight tournaments, and we had discussed, you know, how different it is that programs can elevate to the D1 level when they're ready to make that transition. I mean, even a school like Bryant, which was, you know, winless just a few years back now. It was a contender for a bid this year out of the NEC. But yeah, man, it's just
well, it's an I think there is a somewhat seedier or unfortunate side of that, though.
Yes.
And you've seen it in, and not, you know, I think Belmont is an example of it, you know, one of the most efficiently and perfectly run basketball operations in existence. And as a fan of the A-Sun, I'm sorry that they left, but it seems that we've had someone to come take their place. I mean, the reality is that when a team elevates from Division II or comes in from NAIA, et cetera, there are principles of recruiting and rules and all of those sorts of things that are carried over from previous recruiting classes that come into. So there are sort of situations where there's a transitional period and teams have to wait to be postseason eligible. There's a sort of an advantage that they have that some of the teams that have been in Division I and been working and recruiting under Division I rules this entire time that they don't have. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily what happened with Belmont or what happened with Fort Gulf Coast, but those are elements that we kind of have to consider when you say, well, how can this team have athletes like this? Well, how can this team have built such a program so quickly? Well, part of the transition into Division I has something to do with that.
Yeah, and wasn't even a full-time member until just before last season. Now going to the Sweet 16, Andy Enfield is coach. You know, last week the only thing everyone was talking about was the fact that he married a Maxim model. And people now that we are seeing more of the story of who he is and who he was before he became a coach and just, you know, it seems like a pretty well-rounded guy. And now, by the way, Florida, the Gators, they've got a hell of a draw here, you know, a 14, an 11, and a 15. That's their road to the Elite Eight if they do end up getting through Florida Gulf Coast, which is no guarantee. And it's actually the second straight year that Florida gets a 2 seed, gets a 15 seed. I did not have to play a 2 seed, so I thought that was pretty interesting. So. Yeah, I love the way they play. There has been a little bit of discussion on, hey, you know, part of why we love these guys is that they're number 15, and so they're doing this, and so it's kind of natural. But it's also, I mean, the video on Deadspin that you compiled, there's just such a fearlessness, and I don't want to say carelessness because that's I don't think that's the right word, but the way that these guys just kind of step on the court and don't give a damn at this point in the year, I think is remarkable, because obviously, you know, even someone who follows the sport, I didn't see a Florida Gulf Coast game the entire year, and you wonder how they lose to Lipscomb twice and why they didn't have a bigger and better record. What are your thoughts on just the way the team and the way a story like this really brings a sporting nation together in how they kind of capture our hearts and again, as you said before, allow us to dream?
Well, that's sort of interesting. And Matt, I would have been on top of this team, I think, much earlier in the season because I was in, you know, an Atlantic Sun stronghold in Jacksonville the past several years where we had two Atlantic Sun teams and I was sort of inundated with coverage. But I moved here to St. Petersburg before the season started and not only got away from being in an A-Sun market, but also no longer had access to Comcast Sports South, which broadcast all the A-Sun games. So I was sort of late into this as well. I think one element of the team and the style that they play that's surprising and out of character for previous you know, really small teams that have advanced in the tournament is. Those teams that have succeeded and made it into the second weekend have almost always relied on a very stereotypical sort of team profile, that they play great defense, that they, you know, try to limit the number of offensive rebounds that the other team gets, and so they've increased their defensive rebounding rate, and that they take a lot of three-pointers. And those are not really exhibited by the Florida Gulf Coast. And in fact, you know, for expecting a low, essentially low major team to advance to the second weekend, you're going to look for a team that shoots a lot of three-pointers and does not get very many points in the paint. And, you know, obviously we compiled a dunk video of them. it's just really mind-blowing that to see a team that looks and plays like this, it doesn't fit with our sort of, our mind is conditioned to think, oh, this is what, you know, an Atlantic Sun team that plays well is supposed to look like. They don't look like that. It's disconcerting almost. It's almost a form of, you know, basketball schizophrenia. And I think that's why, you know, the dynamic, exciting team is going to capture everyone. I mean, they could have been a 12 seed and it still would have, you know, taken the nation's attention.
I agree totally. And, you know, with that, they overshadow everything. I mean, Marshall Henderson's now out of the tournament, but as Florida Gulf Coast was getting its freak on and its fly on and its dunk on, Henderson was playing in a good game against LaSalle. He's now out. Ended up actually, I guess, shooting the double bird to some fans who would give it some grief as he was walking off the court. But now LaSalle is in the Sweet 16, which I think is pretty fantastic. You know, that program went through a drought of more than two decades of even making the tournament, let alone winning a game. And now it's gone first four to Sweet 16. Still kind of a relative unknown. They'll get their moment as well coming up. But hey, man, shout out to one of my bosses, Tony Moss, for LaSalle getting to the next round and having a solid shot here. We get this matchup between Wichita State and LaSalle for a berth on the Elite Eight. And it's, you know, every few years we'll have one of those where a Sweet 16 will have two teams pitted against each other that are outside, you know, the seeds 1 through 7. And that one's an intriguing one to me. But we'll get to everything, Eric. Since we didn't have a Friday podcast, and I apologize on that, but, you know, I was in Salt Lake, and I know all you listeners are watching so many games as it is. There really isn't time to squeeze in a podcast. I figured you'd forgive me, and you'll have your other 3 to 4 podcasts this week. I did want to run through the bracket, though, and I'll have Tim speak on plenty of stuff here. But since there was no Friday bracket or Friday podcast, I did want to run through what had happened here. So, you know, Louisville, NCAA, nothing to say. Louisville won. Colorado State, Missouri. Frank Haith now has not won a tournament game with Missouri. Come this time next year, that's going to be a kind of a bigger deal, I think. But CSU was clearly better, and good on them. But with the Mountain West in general, I'll get to that in a bit. They don't get a team into the Sweet 16, and that is pretty disappointing. Oklahoma State over Oregon. Hey, Oregon, we knew it from the start. They were misseeded, and damn, if they don't look really good getting to the Sweet 16 now. Just Oklahoma State was a team that had the pieces, but really got an unfortunate matchup in that first round, and you saw the way that it was almost egg all over the committee's face with the way that the Ducks were able to manage. And then, you know, Oregon went on to beat St. Louis in that round of 32, and they get to the Sweet 16 now. St. Louis was the team, you know, we get a lot of these chic teams in terms of whether it's an upset in the first round or getting to the Sweet 16. St. Louis just got romped by the Ducks. Any thoughts on the top half of that Midwest there between Louisville, you know, kind of steamrolling onto the Sweet 16, taking care of Colorado State or Oregon? I think they surprised plenty of people. I don't think a lot of people had the Ducks getting to the Sweet 16 despite all the talk that they weren't not anything close to a 12, Tim.
Well, I unfortunately or fortunately watched a lot of Pac-12 basketball this year. feeling very fortunate to be one of the chosen who have the Pac-12 network. And you know, Oregon is a complicated team. They're frustrating to watch. You know, they're a team that won a lot of their games by going on long streaks and disappearing for a time and then going on another streak at the end of the game and using that. If they're going to have any chance, and I agree that they were a lot better team than their seed. You know, when Selection Sunday happened, I sort of target. You know, I don't do brackets anymore or predictions or anything like that. But I sort of had a good idea that they had a chance of making it to the second weekend. If they're going to have any chance to go any further, they're going to need to have none of those you know, down periods. They're going to just have a streak the entire game, which is possible. They have really solid athletes on that team. I guess sort of the challenge to me is that there were so many down periods in Pac-12 play that, you know, do they have the focus to sort of maintain that kind of thing? And you know, maybe they do, but I'm not holding out hope for that.
Yeah, Louisville looks so good right now. I mean, just so dominant. They have that look. You know, they've just continued from what they brought in the Big East tournament in Manhattan, and they certainly look like the team that's worthy of the number one overall ranking and one that should not get too much trouble against Oregon. At the bottom half of that Midwest, you know, Memphis and St. Mary's, they had a good one there. You know, Michigan State beat Valpo in the first game of the tournament, kind of off the radar because MSU looks good. I mean, that Michigan State-Memphis game was pretty entertaining for a while, but to see Michigan State kind of outplay Memphis at its own game and put Pastner out to pasture was pretty impressive. But, you know, Josh Pastner does get his first tournament win, so he'll get a little bit of pressure off him in Memphis. We'll see if he ends up getting into heavy talks or heavy rumors with other jobs. We'll get more into that with the Wednesday podcast with Goodman and Parrish. Creighton-Cincy was a decent round of 64 game. Creighton obviously wins. Duke played against Creighton late last night. What did you think about? So you got Duke, Michigan State in the Sweet 16. That's going to be that'll probably be one of the two big headline games of the Thursday Friday, but how about these late tips though on Sunday? I mean, I that Duke Creighton one didn't get underway until about 10 o'clock, and we didn't used to have this. Remember, Tim, because we used to have it was all on CBS, so it was a squeeze, and you tried to get all the games in done by like 7:30, 8 o'clock before 60 Minutes came on. And now we've got a situation where we've got one or two tips on Saturday and Sunday, and the Saturday ones are fine. But I you know, if this has happened the past couple of years, and I guess it has, I just keep forgetting. But to have these teams tip off at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night Eastern time. This was in Philly. This wasn't a West Coast game. I thought that was a little weird, and maybe it draws the viewer out just a little bit, because, you know, a lot of people are in bed by, you know, Sunday night at 11 o'clock. They don't see the end of these games.
Yeah, I think it happened last year too. I seem to remember maybe like Cincinnati, Florida State or something tipping really late on Sunday night. I know either Cincinnati or Florida State played.
Yeah,
really
I get you. Yeah,
the tournaments they kind of blend together. But you know, for people like us, for whom this is our job, it's we don't really think about it. It's just, you know, yeah, we're up. We have more basketball. Here we go. I don't quite understand the philosophy behind running the three CBS games during the day and then running these five night games. Yesterday it worked out pretty well because we let off the day with two very exciting games. I guess 2 days ago, the opening game wasn't competitive at all and we had no other choice. We couldn't go anywhere. If that had happened yesterday, we would have had at least other sports choices. There was there was an IndyCar race going on, and there's a NASCAR race getting ready to start. Yesterday we were fortunate. So the scheduling is strange, and it's awfully, you know, sort of, I guess, inconvenient for fans of those teams who have already took a Friday off, and now, you know, they have to take a Monday off. How much does the NCAA owe its the fans of its member institutions? I mean, all those decisions are essentially made by a committee of people who are from those institutions to begin with. So if it's like if they had an issue with it, that they would have stepped in, you know, at that point. We already make concessions for one NCAA team that won't play on Sundays. So it's, it seems like there would be something there. But, you know, anybody who missed the game last night, I think it was competitive most of the way throughout. I think that, you know, when it comes to that Duke-Michigan State game, it's going to be a high-profile one. But look at how Michigan State's played in this tournament. It's classic, you know, Izzo basketball. He has an innate ability to really sort of, I want to say, bring his players up to a level that they've never played at before in the regular season or in previous seasons. That it's sort of a sublimation. It takes these rocks of players during the regular season and turns them into elevating gases in the postseason. And
I get and, you.
And I think that's one of the things. I mean, that's, you know, I have no love or care either way for the Big Ten, but you know, Izzo throughout his career has always been impressive in getting players who, you know, look at 2000, right? I mean, Mateen Cleaves played out of his head for that postseason, and you know, no matter how much he would have tried in any kind of professional career, he would have never been able to match the performances that he had in leading them to the championship that year.
Down to the West. So I was in Salt Lake, and I got up close and personal with a couple of really good games. The Gonzaga Southern U one, real quick. You know, obviously the Zags are now out, but they dodged infamy in being the first one to go down to a 16. The arena was an interesting vibe because obviously the 16 is going to get the pull in a lot of situations like that. But Gonzaga had a decent contingent there, so it was about 70% of the arena pulling for Southern U, and I personally never thought the game was in doubt, having, you know, sitting there right there on the court watching it play out. I was happy that it was close and enjoying Southern's moxie, but I just never thought Gonzaga was gonna lose control of it, and they didn't. And then the Wichita State game happens, and I did want to just talk real quick on Gonzaga as a program and their season, because they're the first number one to go out. They fail again expectations, both realistically and seed-wise. I mean, this is a team that's failed to live up to its seed expectation quite a few times in Mark Few's tenure. Few's never made an Elite Eight, so there's that to it. But there also is the fact that, like, you kind of balance that, Tim, and you also realize that Wichita State just had the shooting night of its life. I don't have the play-by-play in front of me, but someone had tweeted out the final, like, 14 Wichita State shots that went in, and it was ridiculous. So, you know, they go up against a team that just gets really hot. Before, I mean, Wichita State was 2-for-20 against Pitt from three, and then they hit 14. They shoot 50% from three, including a couple of just gorgeous bombs there. And so part of me is like, you know what, this can just be the break of the tournament. And then the other part of me is, but you look at big picture, and Few and Gonzaga, they kind of continually let you down, right? I mean, what are your thoughts on what they have done this year and how it compares to years past?
Oh, well, Matt, I think that Gonzaga, and I'm not holding their past performance against them, but I think that they suffered this year from a surprisingly down WCC that Gonzaga would have normally faced challenges from not just St. Mary's, but from, you know, Santa Clara, from Loyola, and look at BYU, right? Like BYU was not their typical, and that's what they were supposed to be bringing to the WCC, was, you know, this improved basketball. So that's what I would sort of point to why things went bad for them this year, as opposed to in the past. I don't think it's Mark Few is some sort of, you know, he collapses in his basketball coaching ability in the postseason. I think that's kind of a silly narrative to go through. But, you know, look, Wichita State is a good basketball team. They've been a good basketball team for a very long time. They have an exceptional coaching staff that can prepare them for that's another conference that maybe didn't present its champion with the sort of challenges that they would have had in the past. I guess in this case, you know, they got hot at the right time. But I wouldn't say that this is some sort of a fluke. And now, of course, you know, they have this matchup where, you know, they don't have to play as well as they did against Gonzaga,
right,
to move on, frankly. They're not a flashy team the way that we expect a lot of Sweet 16 competitors to be able to do, but I wouldn't expect the kind of performance they had against Gonzaga. Gonzaga just, you know, they got to this point where it looked like they were sort of drowning and couldn't figure out how to operate the offense that has scored them so many points this season. I don't know if you put that on coaching or on personnel. I mostly put it on a lack of having faced adversity during the season.
I think that's part of it. I had a couple people reach out to me and kind of just lay out the situation culturally from a community standpoint with Gonzaga. You know, it's a very positive place, and there seems to be, and these are Gonzaga fans that are just, you know, I wrote on them after they lost, and they said, listen, it's an extremely different perception locally than nationally. You know, there is no pressure on FIU whatsoever. The community gets tons of support. Spokane as a place is an overwhelmingly positive Northwest city, and so there's this weird juxtaposition. By the time they get to the tournament and are expected to do good things, and there's this national perception, there's still a lot of forgiveness for what the team does regardless of its performance. I will say, you know, I went into just kind of a quick peek behind the curtain, locker room wise. You know, after Southern lost, that was a team that was down but proud. But I will say, and I kind of put this in the column, I mean, I went into that locker room. Everyone was dealing with Gonzaga, the close shave, and so I went into the locker room for Southern, and I think I was the first member. If I wasn't the first, I was the second. There was someone that was around the corner, but I turned the corner into Southern's locker room, and there was just like a row of its players just kind of sitting there, not yet getting undressed, but just kind of sitting, and then they all looked at me at the same time, and it was a weird feeling. But they were pretty good. Gonzaga, after its loss, it's interesting, the dynamics of these locker rooms after losses, and you're not getting a snapshot of the team every single time because you just don't know. But they were down, but okay. Body language was decent. You know, guys checking their phones, which is now a lot of it. A lot of these players, when they lose, they just kind of go to a place of solitude, and they just want to, you know, check their text messages of whatever they're saying, or check Twitter or whatever. And but in general, I mean, you know, Elias Harris was the one that I thought was interesting, because he just kind of sat there, and he was frustrated. He was confused. He didn't know how they lost. This wasn't how it was supposed to end. But it was decent. Then with Wichita State, Greg Marshall, he's willing to talk to anybody. I mean, he's certainly he's an underrated quote machine, and he actually was sitting next to me for the Gonzaga Southern. He was on press row next to me during Gonzaga Southern, scouting Gonzaga, and then Southern's keeping it close, and he's leaning over to me. He's like, "This can't happen, can it? It couldn't happen. It just couldn't happen, Matt." And it almost did. But after the game, I mean, that team is a lot of fun. Carl Hall, their center who missed some time this year, he is a great personality, man. I hope he gets a chance to shine in terms of pregame stuff for the media. They were a blast. They were dancing in front of the pep band. A really fun scene. And that group is just, that's an ambitious yet regular set of guys that I saw in that locker room, and I think they're going to have a good chance against LaSalle, who beat Ole Miss, beat Marshall Henderson. So Marshall Henderson's out, which is okay. I mean, he had his moments there. He kind of lived up to it in terms of a quote machine, and he actually, you know, he went out across the street from the Sprint Center on, what was it, Thursday, I guess, or Friday? I can't remember, forgive me, and I guess had a pop or two. And then once that got on the internet, apparently, Ole Miss was like, okay, back to the hotel immediately. And I wanted your thoughts real quick on Henderson because his season gets put to bed here. There are a lot of varying opinions. Some like him, some don't. Some are okay with some of his stuff and not with others. You know, he gave the double-barreled finger salute to the fans after they had said something about his sister and his past with cocaine. He's a very emotional guy, and I just didn't know what your thoughts were now that the Ole Miss, you know, lost after a near buzzer beater to LaSalle on Sunday.
As a member of the exploitative sports media, it would be against my best interests to say anything other than I think Marshall Henderson is fantastic and needs to continue doing exactly what he's doing. As somebody in SEC country who's watching, you know, a lot of SEC basketball, you know, you saw this coming. You saw this development of a guy who very much wanted you to know he was there. And, you know, that's not out. I mean, remember, let's think about where Andy Kennedy comes from and his coaching background. They've tolerated, you know, players like that before. And frankly, as not good as Ole Miss basketball has been for so long, or I guess Ole Miss athletics in general, you know, I'm not gonna sort of stand in the way of them celebrating that. I'm not bothered by his behavior. I'm not, you know, clutching my pearls and thinking, you know, my goodness. I think that the kid's kind of a punk, but you know what? There's way, way worse dudes in college basketball than Marshall Henderson. Those bad dudes are just not as good as Marshall Henderson, so they're not getting his kind of attention.
Yeah, I think that's a solid point. And you know, it would have been nice to have him into the Sweet 16, just from a storyline angle. But you know, FGCU will carry that for a while and do a plenty good job with it. And so we wait and we see what happens from here. As for the rest of that region, real quick, you know, with Wisconsin and Kansas State, both of them losing, K-State a 4, Whiskey a 5. You know, some of these seasons, because the tournament is such a fast-churning machine, you've got these teams who can be so anonymous, largely speaking, with the general sports public, and K-State was chief among those. And then they lose, and it's just up in a plume of smoke. I mean, just like that, the loss occurs, and the season's over. LaSalle ended up pulling out that game by 2. I'm just always interested to see the few teams. This happened to Michigan last year. You're in a bad TV window, and suddenly it's like, oh, they lost. Oh, their season's it's just done. And K-State was one of those. Wisconsin, hey, with the style they play, they're always going to be a good team under Bo Ryan. They've never finished outside fourth in the Big Ten. But unfortunately, it does get to be a bit of a crapshoot in the tournament, and that's why he's never made a Final Four with that team. And generally, it's just a little risky to even put Wisconsin into the Sweet 16 because when they play that ball control offense and there are so few possessions, then obviously if it's close, your odds of losing go up, and so Wisconsin falls again. In the bottom half of the West, Arizona had no issues with Belmont. If you're interested in Belmont at all, I did spend all day Wednesday with them, just kind of leading up to that game, just to get an idea of who Rick Bird was, how they prepped, and so on the blog, and I'll link it in the podcast post here. I just have an insight to what they are, and I thought that was pretty interesting what the coaches and what Bird revealed to me. But Arizona, they steamrolled to the Sweet 16. Because they beat Belmont, they take care of Harvard, and Arizona's looking like the team it was at the start of the season, looks Final Four ready, and looks like, to me, the best team in this region right now. We'll see what happens there. As for Harvard, felt pretty cool to be in Salt Lake, to be there for history and Harvard's first win in the tournament ever. It's only their fourth appearance. But I will ask, I mean, if you want to springboard off Harvard or talk New Mexico, or talk Mountain West in general now, because we can do that as well. I mean, Harvard won, so it was like a casual win. It wasn't like that dramatic. They won 68-62, and this wasn't like some massive moment because they did it so casually. And in doing so, knock out New Mexico, the flagship team for the Mountain West, who just doesn't get to another Sweet 16 again. And New Mexico hasn't been there since 74. And so now the boobirds kind of come out for the MWC because people are like, okay, let's wait. Let's see what they do in the tournament. And despite the small sample size, they aren't able to get one team into the second weekend.
Well, you know, I'm not going to shed any tears for, you know, an MWC that overall has seen success beyond its means the past few seasons. That, you know, that Harvard sort of, you know, cruised to that win that you said, you know, they made it look easy. That's not especially a surprise either if you've, I guess, watched Harvard play over the past couple of seasons. You know, they have developed that program into a machine and have looked for players who buy completely into the system, believe in it, and work through it like it's a, you know, an assembly line. And so that, you know, that was exciting to see, although, you know, among Ivy League schools that I'm going to get excited about seeing win an NCAA tournament game, you know, Harvard, yay, right? It's, they're not Brown or, you know, even like, you know, Cornell's run to the Sweet 16, what, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
I think I got a little more excited for that. But you mentioned, you know, Arizona, and you want to talk about a guy who's built a team that, that buys into his, and then, you know, Sean Miller's approach to basketball is very different than Tommy Amaker's. But, you know, that's a guy who has, you know, developed something that I think works better in the NCAA tournament than maybe it does in conference play or even out of conference play. And Sean Miller, I think, has done that. He did it at Xavier. He's doing it at Arizona now. And while, you know, as sort of a mid-major basketball fan, I was excited when Momo Jones went to Iona. You know, now I'm wishing that he had never left because I would like to see what this Arizona team looked like.
Yeah, but I think you can make the argument that Arizona is not necessarily the same if Momo's on the team there. To me, I was surprised by it. See, Harvard's going to be really nasty next year. They've got top 75 recruit and a top 200 recruit, plus they get Brandon Curry and Kyle Casey back, who weren't playing this year because of academic stuff. Listen, they New Mexico is a solid team. A bad night in terms of shooting, which they were prone to do because they weren't a reliable offensive team, and Harvard had some shots fall that didn't happen to fall against Zona. We're kind of running long here, but I don't mind because the bracket was awesome. Real quick on Ohio State, to me, certainly can make the Final Four. I did not think that was the case before the bracket began playing. I do like Arizona still to beat Ohio State, but Kraft, listen, he can be, he's so reliable defensively, but I know that he can be a little frustrating overall to some Ohio State fans because he did have plenty of mistakes leading up to the end of that Iowa State game, which was really a fantastic game on Sunday. But I think, to me, that's one of the best games of the Sweet 16, Arizona-Ohio State. We'll see what happens there. You know, teams like, you know, Notre Dame didn't really have a shot in that bottom half of that West Regional. And I'm just glad that ISU gave us a good one. A little frustrating for ISU fans because they're on the wrong end of some calls. I'm not going to get into the block charge stuff that's been talked about plenty on the internet, on Twitter, and you've heard all too much about that. On the other side, on the right side, Miami into the Sweet 16 will play Marquette. I think that's a fantastic game, personally. Love to see, you know, the Jim Larrañaga dance, or the boxing, whatever that was. I thought that was great. Like, Florida Gulf Coast gave us a lot of GIF opportunities, but Jim Larrañaga, Tim, I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's on our site. And is it? Did you get it? I'm sure you got it on Deadspin, right?
We may have it. We may get it up this morning. I saw it happen, but I was working on the FGCU dunk video. Yeah, Jim Larrañaga, you know, he left George Mason to go to Miami, and we all said, oh, this is his. And I say this as somebody who has known him, you know, not really personally, but, you know, through my dad and being in the Northwest Ohio basketball community. probably 20 years. And, you know, we all sort of said, okay, well, this is Jim retiring. He's going to go, you know, have assistants do his recruiting, do most of the coaching, and he's going to spend his time out on the beach. That's what we all thought.
Yes.
And now this is not retirement. This is Jim Larranaga working maybe harder than he's ever worked in his career and doing a great job. And, you know, that's exciting for me to see. I wish that he was still doing it with George Mason, I think. But he's getting stuff out of those Miami players that they really have no business doing. That, you know, players are finding skills that they didn't know that they had, and they're doing it with a really loose, comfortable atmosphere that they feel very relaxed. And you sort of see it that they're excited and they celebrate with these big wins, and they've had some big wins this season. But they're not, I don't want to say they're not boastful, but they sort of, and maybe this has something to do with the early season loss to Florida Gulf Coast. It was, humbling or something, whatever it is. Miami is a team that looks like they know what they're doing, and in college basketball, that's exciting and refreshing.
Yeah, and they had a close shave. Props to Illinois, who got by Colorado and really had a shot at it on Sunday night. But yeah, and I think a lot of that could be with age. They've got some older guys on that team. And I still like Miami's chances to get to the Final Four. Elsewhere, you know, Marquette has done a solid job. Buzz Williams makes his third Sweet 16. He had some interesting quotes just in general to the media about how he doesn't want to be as seen as Mr. Tactician, because Buzz is actually a quirky guy. He cares a lot about tempo free stats, does a lot of prep that way, but that's not – he had come out and said that's not what he wants to be known for. He wants to be known for his teams to be passionate, intense, very, very tough, and I thought that was – Buzz is always interesting. He's always a good quote. But, you know, Marquette had a couple of fantastic games and managed to move on. They've actually had, I think their past eight games have been decided by 8 points or less, but they beat Davidson. They have the escape of all escapes in a loss for Davidson that just has to make any Davidson fan kind of rip their hair out, because that turnover that allowed Marquette to get the game was just an all-time brain lock of a pass and turnover, where you just kind of see it developing. And you're like, no, but yeah, Marquette gets it to the Sweet 16. Good job by them. Butler obviously falls in the round of 32 after getting the win against Bucknell, and so Brad Stevens and company prepare to go to the new Big East. At the top, Syracuse looks really good into the Sweet 16. They dominated Montana, and they were able to take care of Cal. I did miss the end of that game. I was driving. I was desperately trying to make the airport out in Salt Lake City after filing my Gonzaga column. UNLV, they go out to Cal, a fantastically talented team that completely underperformed. Anthony Bennett is already off to the NBA. So a bit of a wasted season for the fifth-ranked Rebels, who at year's beginning, I think a lot of us thought they had three-seed capability and Final Four potential that never came to be. NC State, another team just like Vegas, just a complete flame out, had a lot of talent, couldn't get it done. They get beat by Temple. Temple actually gave Indiana a really, really, really good game. I mean, Khalif Wyatt, for anyone that watched that Indiana Temple game and you saw the way that Khalif Wyatt played and you were enjoying it, he has done that throughout his career. He is the definition of killing you softly, the way that he plays. And props to Fran Dunphy's team for giving Indiana a really good game that the Hoosiers ended up winning by 6. So it'll be Indiana-Syracuse in the Sweet 16. I've actually got Syracuse winning that game. I think the Hoosiers I find them more fallible than most. What about you, Tim?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I don't know that there's a whole lot that I could add to that statement. I think it's there are cracks.
Yes.
There, and you know, The thing about cracks in any foundation is you know, they only really come into play when the temperature changes. So I guess you can sort of draw your own NCAA tournament analogy from that.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Into the final region here, the South, which is where I'll be in Arlington for the Sweet 16. Georgetown fans, I guess, have to take a little bit of solace in the fact that, you know, when they've been taken out, they've lost to, what, VCU, Florida Gulf Coast, and they've had some fortunate placement of their losses, even though they, since they made the Final Four in 07, they've only lost to double-digit seeds in the tournament. I guess Davidson was another team that knocked them out. And so I guess if that's any sort of consolation, I don't know. We've gone into Florida Gulf Coast extensively. We will on every single episode this week because there's still so much to learn and so much to talk about with that team. But elsewhere, UCLA, Minnesota. Minnesota wins. Palland is now gone. We'll get into in terms of the program stuff at another pod another time. But that was kind of they were ready to check out on the season. Minnesota won easily. Florida is looking particularly good, particularly Final Four ready. This is the team that all the data suggests and the statistical predictional models suggest will make the Final Four. And now they get Florida Gulf Coast. I would love it if they kept it close, because the crazy thing about Florida is that they have not won a game that has been decided by single digits. Every time they win comfortably. So can the Eagles keep that one close? I really hope so. I'd love to get, and that's the late game on Friday. I think that is the second tip in Dallas. So I'd like to see that personally. At the top half, Nate Walters went out to Michigan, who, by the way, just destroyed. VCU destroyed Akron, and then I think it had to have had the biggest switch in margin between how they romped Akron 88-42, and then they went down to Michigan 78-53. Michigan is my Final Four pick. They look really good. And then at the top half of there, you've got them going against Kansas, who was able to handle North Carolina. Good job by Self to get that team to yet another Sweet 16. And North Carolina just expired what their ceiling was. You know what? A round of 32 appearance against the number one seed. I think they did pretty good. Overall, any impressions from any team that's left in that South Regional, Tim?
That is... Yeah, sorry, my wife is taking pictures of me.
No, that's fine. I love the elements of this podcast. You never know what's going to happen. It's all good.
I think there are more, I guess, more questions. I mean, you talk about Florida, right? Yeah. And that they've had, you know, these comfortable wins. I watched a lot of Florida basketball this year, and you know, it's like eight out of every 10 games, that's four out of every five, right? Reduce our fractions.
Yes.
Four out of every five games, they are completely locked in. They execute perfectly. Guys go really strong to the basket. And they shoot relatively well. But then there's that sort of fifth game. And a lot of times this year, they got away with it in the fifth game. You know, obviously in the NCAA tournament, your odds, I guess, of stringing together that 80% chance game is much better. If Florida actually does that, if Florida doesn't have that 1-in-5 drop the ball game, mm-hmm. I think that they have a real chance of winning the championship, even though they aren't that talented of a basketball team. It's one of those Billy Donovan things that is tough to explain. He sort of does this magic. He throws some things in a hat and pulls out the rabbit. I don't know that they have a chance of, because again, they've already done it. They've done it twice. They have to do it four more times, and they have to escape getting that 1-in-5 drop the ball game. And I think that'll probably happen. But if it doesn't, I think that they're probably going to win.
You bring up a really good point. I think that's talk that is coming because while the statistical models really like Florida, people aren't really entertaining this team as a national title team in general, despite the fact that it's number one in KenPom. We'll see. It will have one of those games because every team, almost every champion or even Final Four team or every team that loses, because that's their game, will have a game like that, and it's a matter of can you overcome it? Does Florida have the personnel to do it? I don't know. We'll see. Real quick before we wrap up here, what is... Give me your Sweet 16 game between Kansas, Michigan, Florida, FGCU, Indiana, Syracuse, Marquette, Miami, Arizona, Ohio State, Wichita State, LaSalle, Louisville, Oregon, and Michigan State, Duke. For whatever reason, which of those is the matchup you're looking forward to most?
Oh, this may be stereotypical, but it really is that Wichita State and LaSalle game. Obviously, you know, there's a lot riding on this for me and LaSalle. My colleague Dom Cosentino and the guy who hired me at Deadspin, AJ Delorio, both having graduated from LaSalle. But, you know, these are two, you know, historic mid-major programs. LaSalle is on a run that they have not seen in decades. And, you know, they're,
what in the name of Tom Gola is going on out there?
Well, you got to understand, too, though, that every team that is in the Philadelphia market, and that includes the unfairly excluded from the Big Five, Drexel, all of those schools have sort of a recruiting advantage that nobody else does. And so there's always a chance at any time that any of them could explode and have a team that's, you know, possibly Final Four worthy. And we'll get St. Joe's, right? I'm not saying LaSalle's going to the Final Four, but I'm saying that we shouldn't be surprised that they've put together a team that is capable of advancing in the tournament.
All right. Well, the remaining true seeds here, and shout out to Greg Sheehan for tweeting this, are, so these were the teams that were ranked by the committee before the start. You got 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 16, and then you get 21, 35, 43, 49, and then 59 is Florida Gulf Coast. It's going to be fun. You know, it wasn't the most epic first 4 days. It was plenty crazy. It was unlike anything we had. The tournament gives us this every year, a different kind of domino effect. I was wrong. I didn't think we'd get this much general craziness into the second weekend. We still have, you know, we still obviously have three number ones around, so it wasn't total chaos or total destruction, but plenty of surprise there. Follow Tim on Twitter pretty much for any, I mean, if you're the kind of person that wants to see immediate reaction and video and gifts to anything, Tim is the man, at Bubba Prague, fantastic writer as well. Appreciate you coming back on and again bringing that sweet, dulcet, NPR-like tone. It is always appreciated, Matt.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Matt.
All right, thank you so much. We will be back again Wednesday podcast with Goodman and Parrish is coming up. I might be able to squeeze in a Tuesday one, though, so trying to get some more stuff in for you this week. Hope you enjoyed, and we will talk to you soon.